Okay, so the first thing I want to do is back up and deal with Robin's point that he made at the end of the discussion yesterday, where he said, oh, look, my Greek text, the Textus Receptus, actually has this word spiritual in the text. And of course, that led me to the NA28, which I have, and two other Greek texts. And sure enough, it's there. So let's make sure that I correct a misleading statement from yesterday. Okay? Because I wanted to talk about the word that we translate as gift, charisma. Okay? And what I wanted to say is that the word gift implies a spiritual connection already. So I don't need both words in order to communicate what Paul's doing. But I mistakenly might have indicated that what was really happening is that this word spiritual, pneumatikoin, wasn't even in the text, but it is in the text, right? It's just that Paul is taking the word charisma and modifying it to say it's of a particular kind of gift that I want to bring you, okay? So what is that particular kind of gift? Because that's what we want to deal with. And for that, I have, where is it? Oh my gosh, just to fall over the place here. Ah, so I sent you out a bunch of notes, right? And you have them in the extra material. And guess what? The first one, which is Romans 1:1 to 1:15, has now been revised. So in your material, there's a revision for this particular verse to qualify what's actually happening in the verse. So you can download that material again, replace the one you have, and there's a little note in there in the middle of it. And it reads like this. It's from the Theological Dictionary of the New Testament, which you may or may not have. And it's about this particular word, charisma, which is the word that Paul uses. And it's important I'm going to read you some pieces from the note here. It's important to realize that it's not a typical kind of word. So basically it says, this rare and late verbal noun of charizomai, the verb, denotes the result of grace, the result of charis as an action, that is, a proof of favor or a benefit. And then there's a paragraph about Paul's use. He says, the author writes, Paul uses the word in Romans 1 and 2 Corinthians and in the pastoral epistles. He relates it to charis and pneuma, which is the word for spirit, in soteriological context. That soteriological means in salvation context. It occurs in the preface to Romans, which is what we're talking about, and in 1st and 2nd Corinthians, and takes shape as gifts in Romans 12:6, so we're going to find it again in the 12th chapter, and 1 Corinthians 12:11. Linked with Eucharisto, which from which we get Eucharist, which is of course our idea of the communion, right? It also has eschatological orientation. So here's what they conclude. You can read the rest of it because I printed that in the revised notes that you have. Okay. And what he basically is saying is this, this unusual and rare word is used by Paul to link two things. The idea that we have a gift of some sort present now, that gift is the actionable part of grace, but it's provisional, because what's going to happen later will be the permanent implementation of the idea of this word. So when Paul says, I'm going to bring you a spiritual gift, I was correct in saying he's not being Platonic. And this is really the important point. He's not saying that there's a spiritual world and a physical world, and I'm going to bring you something from the spiritual world because the physical world doesn't matter. That's not what he's saying. And in fact, if you read the little note that I sent, you'll discover, actually you could read the longer article, it's only 200 or 300 pages, right? You'll discover that in the Hebrew context, what happens as a result of God proving a benefit to us happens in the physical world, not in the heavenly spiritual world. So the dualism that I pointed out doesn't exist in Paul. But the idea that there's a temporary manifestation or provision of God's benefit leading to a final and full benefit sometime in the eschaton, sometime later, that is in Paul, right? So we're going to take the Platonic idea and set it aside. No separation, no concrete wall between spiritual and physical. But we are going to include a temporal element in which Paul would say, I'm bringing you a gift now, a pneumatic way, a spiritual gift, which you will experience now in part, but you won't experience the fullness of it until the eschaton, until the return. Okay? Does that help, Robin? Because what it says is, okay, it's in the text. Now let's make sure that we understand what Paul's saying. And what Paul is not saying is that that somehow you're going to get a gift from heaven that's different than the world that you live in, right? Everything that happens in a Hebraic context happens here. Okay? Does that settle that part? Good. I want to make that correction. Okay. Now let's move on. I think we're at verse 16. So now let's move on to 16. And these next two verses are really packed with stuff because basically Paul uses one of the prophets as a kind of touchstone of what he wants to do and how he's going to develop the thoughts of righteousness, salvation, justification, all that kind of stuff. And he uses a particularly interesting connection to a prophet that you probably know of, but we'll see how he develops that. Okay, so I need to put my bookmark here in the Greek text so I know where I am. Okay, so let's take a look at the text, and I'm going to give you the NASB 95 translation, and then we'll talk about the Greek text. Okay, so it reads like this: For I'm not ashamed of the gospel, for it is the power of God for salvation to everyone who believes, to the Jew first and also to the Greek. Okay, now we've got a couple of things we have to talk about here, but we'll talk about the simple ones first. Okay, the simple ones is that Paul is not making a distinction between Jews and Greeks. I know it says Greek, but the word in Greek is Hellenes. So he's really making a distinction between Jews and the Hellenes, that is, the members of the Hellenistic world, okay? So it's not an ethnic division. It's not the difference between those born Jewish and those born Greek. It's the difference between those who are Jews because of their orientation and those who are Hellenes, Hellenists, because of their orientation, right? Because I can be a Hellenist and not be a Greek, obviously. And consequently, I can also be a Jew and not be Jewish, right? How is that possible? Because the assembly that Paul's writing to is made up of proselytes, Gentiles who are Messianic believers, Orthodox Jews, and Jews who are Messianic believers. So there's both Jews and Gentiles in that, the Jew and Gentile ethnic division, but inside the assembly, in terms of their orientation and obedience, they're being Jewish, okay? And it's that in opposition to being Hellenized, okay? So we want to recognize that whoever he's talking about, whatever the message is, it's first to those who are being Jewish and second to those who are part of the Hellenistic world, okay? Not Jew and Greek, Jew and Hellen. Okay, now, since we got that settled, let's go back and take a look at the beginning of this. For I'm not ashamed, okay? Because if you don't know the audience, you don't know why he's using these particular words, okay? So I give you the Greek here, and I tell you, of course, that the combination epi, which usually means upon, in this particular Greek sense, epi is used as a kind of linguistic exclamation point. You know, there is no punctuation in Greek, just like there's no punctuation in Hebrew. So if I want to put emphasis to something, I add the prefix epi to it. So here, Paul is saying, literally, I'm not ashamed, exclamation point, because of the way that he constructs the verb, okay? So he says, I'm not ashamed of the gospel. And now, of course, we have this term, right, which we know, right? is evangelon, where we want to know what that means. And the question was, okay, well, what does the gospel of God mean? And of course, we want to translate that as the good news. And the kosher Paul reads as follows. The truth is, I'm not ashamed of the good news message. And of course, the good news message is the kingdom of God on earth, which is what Yeshua is talking about, right? When Yeshua says that I've come to declare to you the kingdom of God on earth, and the kingdom is among you, and all of the phrases that he uses those as circumlocutions, like the kingdom of heaven is a circumlocution for not saying the word God. Okay, he's being very culturally appropriate. All right. But the kingdom that we're talking about is the good news. And what is that good news? I summarized it yesterday in two words: God cares. But we can expand on that to say now that the character of God, which we find in Exodus 34, 6, and 7, is representative of what it means to be a member of the kingdom that takes on the perspective of being Jewish, right? So by the time we get to the end of the verse, it's not surprising that Paul would say, hey, to everyone that believes, those who are being Jewish, which of course means that their lifestyle is directed by the Tanakh, right? And now he's going to try to reach out to another community. But the power that God, the gospel of that the power of God is the ability to shift my perspective so that I act in accordance with the Tanakh. And that's the good news that's coming along, because no longer am I under the influence of a pagan deity that's forcing me to complete some rituals or believe some certain thing without being, in opposition to being punished. Now I'm embracing a God who actually cares about me and who describes what it means to be like him and rewards me for doing that. So it's good news all the way around. Okay, now he says, for it is the power of God for salvation. And of course, that's a big term. And I've said in my notes, the important aspect of the verb in Romans 1:16 is that it's in the middle voice. The Greek, but we don't have a middle voice in English, by the way. The Greek voice that emphasizes something of significance to the subject. So the subject, when he says, for I'm not ashamed of the gospel, what he's saying is, this is not only does it have an exclamation point after the verb, but it's something that is of significance to me, important to me, and of course, important to anyone who embraces the being Jewish perspective. Okay? So he says, and it is passive, which means that it's something that happens to me, not something that I do. Okay? Passive action. Something or someone else does something that affects me. Okay? The sense of putting myself to shame, Paul uses the word for oop, which is the word for not. It's a spelling that comes before the next verb the next word that has a vowel. Otherwise, it would be oo, O-U. Okay? This is the very, very strong word for the negative in Greek. There's another Greek word, me, which means conditionally no, but oo means unconditionally no. Right. So what he's saying is absolutely under no circumstances will I ever be ashamed for the good news that I'm telling you about God's caring, because, and now he gives you the reason, because it is the power by which this other action, salvation, occurs. And so we're going to look at that. OK, but you'll note in my notes here that I say once again, the NIV leaves out the term gar, which means therefore. And in our NASB, it's for I am not ashamed. But once I leave that out, it makes me think that this is a separate topic. And it's not a separate topic because, as we recognize, the first 15 verses are the introduction to the audience of what Paul is doing and why he's doing it. And now he provides the conclusion of all that introduction by saying, because of all of that, therefore this. Okay? So we need that. Okay? So Paul adds the reason for his confidence. The gospel is the gospel is the power of God. And the word power, you'll recognize it, dynamos or dunamos. Interestingly enough, we get the word dynamite from that. Notice that it's not just words, it's action. So he's not talking about a set of beliefs. He's talking about a way of living, right? So if the power of God is not just, is not a creedal a statement that I ascribe to, but it's actually the way that I live, then that makes perfect sense in terms of the audience he's speaking to. Because those people who are being Jewish take over a particular kind of way of acting in the world, right? One of the attractions in the first century and prior to the first century, in the third, second century BC, or BC, one of the attractions of Judaism in the Roman Empire was the way that the people behaved, how they lived, their emphasis on family, their emphasis on values for the society, their devotion to God. And that acted as a magnet to attract Gentiles to the Jewish faith, right? It was based not on the descriptions of some theology, a statement of beliefs. It was based on the way that they behaved in the society, okay? In fact, they were so well received in the society that some emperors actually gave them special permission to observe Shabbat and not work on that day, and they had some tax exemption, which is the basis for what happened later with all of the revolt that went on. It was about the money. Okay, so let's continue now. So he says, it's the power, the action of God for salvation. So now we want to know, what does that word mean? Okay, and you'll notice in my notes, I say, what is the purpose and direction of this power? Salvation. Soterion. It is a general classification word that covers justification, redemption, and sanctification. So let's talk about each one of those things, because we're going to run across the same words for them anyway. We're going to talk about dikaiosune. We're going to talk about elios. We're going to talk about all the different Greek terms that are summarized in this. Okay. So tell me what you think when I say justification, redemption, and sanctification. What does that cause you to? How would you define those words? Let's start with justification. How is justification different than redemption and different than sanctification? What do you think happens there?
Does it mean that you're worthy of it? Is justification...
Okay. So you might think of justification like validation, which means that in validation, it says, okay, the action or the statement is accounted as true. It's validated. But justification isn't quite the same as validation. Validation is sort of like a stamp of approval. Justification, think of justification in the legal sense. Okay, if I go into court and after the court hearing, I say, I've been justified, what do I mean?
My innocence has been proven?
Not necessarily innocence, but certainly I've been shown to be not guilty. You know, in our system in America, there's guilty and not guilty. In the British system, there's guilty, not guilty, and innocent. Guilty only means that you weren't proven to be not guilty. Innocent means that you actually didn't do it. Okay? So if I'm justified in a legal sense in the first century, it shows that I'm no longer held guilty. And of course, that's exactly what I need from God's perspective, because even though I am guilty of infraction, I'm not accounted that way. Okay?
You're right? Cleared of your, so justification, you're cleared of your whatever issues. It's gone.
Yes. Yes. Okay. So it's a forensic term that means that I'm no longer held responsible. It doesn't mean that I didn't do it. It means that even if I did it, I'm not being held responsible for it. The punishment has been removed. Okay? Justified. Okay. What about redeemed, redemption, justification, redemption? What's the difference between justification and redemption? Well, redemption has a very old Testament, Tanakh, history. That's why Paul can say this word summarizes all these things, right? Because when you think about redemption, you think about a payment, a purchase of someone so that his debts are relieved and he owes someone else, right? So when God redeems Israel from Egypt, it doesn't mean that Israel is then scot-free. It means that the price was paid to remove the people from Pharaoh as their sovereign and put them under Yotvahe as the sovereign, Hashem, right? It doesn't mean that they were relieved of all debt. It means that their ownership was transferred from one sovereign to another. They were redeemed, paid for one sovereign, and now owe their existence to another. Okay? Got that?
So, Skip, that's like when people, yes, when people hear the Exodus story, because in the argument, the fights, the plagues, and Moses goes to Pharaoh and says, let my people go, but they forget the rest of it. It's let my people go so that they may serve me. There's rest,
sure,
of it, so that's it. Redeemed, taken out, brought out, you know, with the strong arm, so that there's a, like you said, there's an obligation in that, so that they may serve.
Right.
That's the redemption.
Right.
And then
so
in regeneration, we have a redeemer. Or
yes. So redemption is basically the change of title from one owner to another. It isn't the erasing of the title. It's the shift from one title to another, right? I redeem, and basically the term in Hebrew means to make a payment for, okay? To redeem.
Well,
it's, by the way, only one of many Hebrew terms, all with different kinds of nuances about what God does with with Israel and how that affects the citizens of the kingdom. But in this particular case, we're certainly talking about first justified, that is, having the sentence of guilty removed, and second, redeemed, being bought from one sovereign and owned now by another. And then the final term here is sanctified. So what would you say sanctification means? And this is important because there are nuances in Christian theology about what happens here. Okay. So what is sanctified? Yeah, Adi.
Escape.
Yeah.
Yeah, on that context, can I just say something? I always argue that we don't have free will, but we have free choice. Because when we are redeemed from Egypt, we have another master. So we're not redeemed to do whatever we want to do. We are redeemed to serve God. So we don't really have free will. We have free choice of who we're going to serve.
Yeah, and you find that exactly in Yeshua's remark, no man can have two masters, who serve one or serve the other, right? But he never says no man can have two masters, he can just get rid of all of them, right? It doesn't happen that way. He's serving one or he's serving the other, okay? Yeah, so you're right. Now, go ahead, Lindy.
I was just going to say, if you liken it to what Hanukkah, we were redeemed, there was a redeemer, there was a salvation, there was Mattathias, Judas Maccabee. And then we sanctified the temple so that we could return to worship and serve God, because we, up to that point, we were not able to. It's all embodied in what today, right now, Hanukkah. And sanctified is again being dedicated to or rededicated to.
Isn't sanctification,
yes,
also
but,
moral purity?
I'm sorry. What did you say, Dennis? I didn't hear it.
Isn't a sanctification like moral purity? Because we always have to.
Okay. Yeah, and that's the point I wanted to make. In some Christian theology, the idea of sanctification is equivalent to piety, right? Which means getting more, and as Dennis pointed out, it's progressive purification. So the idea is that the standard is perfection. And sanctification is the process by which your life becomes more and more purer so that eventually you will be perfect for God. Okay? That's in Christian theology, it's called progressive sanctification. Okay? And the reason I want to raise that is because it seems to me, after following Matthew Wilson's book, which you probably can't get anymore, but because it's not a print, but this book, right? The Simplicity of Holiness, he talks about this whole idea of sanctification. What he points out is that in Paul's letters, Paul never talks about the process of becoming sanctified. And I made that point when we first looked at the Greek term for saint, right? Agios. Paul treats his audience as though they already are sanctified. Now, you're going to say, well, wait a minute. How is that possible? Look at the actions of the Corinthians. They're all over the place, right? They do morally disgusting things. How can Paul treat them as agios? And the point is, Paul's version of what it means to be sanctified is only is the connection to the Messiah, not necessarily the moral behavior of the person, right? Certainly, and you can see this in the Acts 15 description, when Paul justifies his proclaiming the good news to Peter and John and the Jerusalem council, what do they say? They say, oh, yeah, okay, you can continue to have the Gentiles come into the assembly under these four conditions, and they give the four conditions, because every week they will hear Moses. So what have they said? They're coming into the assembly because they're connected to the Messiah, but their lifestyle will change as they learn about Moses. Okay? In other words, as they embrace the Tanakh. Does that mean that they're not acceptable until they finally embrace all of the Tanakh? Of course not. That was Paul's argument. They're acceptable because they have a relationship with the Messiah, and therefore they are already, from God's perspective, sanctified. They're already, they've already shifted paradigms. Now it's a matter of education after sanctification, not education before sanctification, right? And we want to make that claim here in this verse, because as we read through the rest of Paul, you know, he's got lots of instructions. He's saying you should do this, you should do this, and don't do that, and don't do that. But if we think he's giving them instructions so that they will become better, so that God will accept them more, we've missed the point. The point is, he's not talking about moral instructions in order to get them to improve their relationship with God. What he's saying is, you already have the relationship. Now live accordingly. And I'll help you understand what that means. You see? You see the difference? Yes, Pam. You have to turn your microphone on. Can't hear you. Oh, okay. Yes.
I don't really want to go on a long rabbi trail, but I've been reading Soloveitchik for a while now, and I always question, what does he mean exactly by redeemed? To redeem, you know, the lonely man and bring him, and those, and now this is related to all that, right? Basically, we buy ourselves back from the natural man, and are sanctified in the metaphysical man. So this has been very helpful. Thank you. It's really hard to, his definitions are so different.
Yes, and okay, but you have to understand that we're trying to deal with Paul in the rabbinic context of the first century. And Soloveitchik is writing in the rabbinic context of the 20th century. So a lot of things happened between the first century and the 20th century, including a massive influence of Hellenism in the rabbinic world, right? So in fact, if you read some of the later rabbis, and it's even in the Siddur, I can show you Platonic and Neoplatonic ideas that have made their way into rabbinic thinking along this long chain of Hellenizing the Western world. Okay? But now we're trying to get back to the first century, where Paul is saying, okay, what does this stuff mean? And in order to understand Paul, we must always relate it back to some issue in the Tanakh, because he's much closer to the world that is not so Hellenized, as we are 20 centuries later. Okay? And when we finally finish all this, and we really want to understand how that all happened, then we will do this. Martin Engel. Then we'll have to do this book. Right? Right? Judaism and Hellenism, Martin Engel. And as you can see, it's nice and long, 700 pages. But the other seven, this is volume one. The other 700 pages are 700 pages of footnotes in volume two. Okay? So this book is about what happened in that Hellenistic world so that we end up with a Judaism that's very different than the kind of Judaism that existed before the Babylonian captivity and the influences that happened. We've talked a little bit about this historically in some of our other studies, the influences that happened that shifted not just the, you know, the pagan world of Hellenism, but shifted the Jewish world as well. Right? And we start to see these themes show up so that in fact you could look at Judaism and say, oh my gosh, there's a theme for progressive salvation in Judaism as well. Getting closer and closer to God because you're fulfilling more and more of the commandments. Okay. What we have to realize is we need to back up from that and say, okay, wait a minute. When Paul talks about this, he's not giving instructions to pagans in order for them to become righteous so that God will accept them. That's never Paul's approach. Paul's approach is you have a relationship with the Messiah. On the basis of that relationship, you're entering into a Jewish assembly, which already has a long history. Your status in the assembly is anchored in your relationship to the Messiah, not your relationship to the laws of the Tanakh. You will learn those and become more and more Jewish in the process, but the entry pass has already been given. Right? Question. You're not, excuse me, you're not earning your way to heaven by completing the laws, as Moshe Kempinski in Jerusalem would tell you. We don't think of the commandments as obligations. We think of them as opportunities to show our love for God. So we're already there. We're already in the assembly. We've already accepted the paradigm. Now we need to know how to live it. That's all. It doesn't make us more perfect so that God is evaluating you on your curve, right, on the curve. It makes it possible for you to understand how you live with this paradigm. Yes, Dennis, you have something?
Is there any relationship between sanctification and the mikvah?
Of course, because the mikvot are the way that we live. And sanctification is the introduction that allows me to have a paradigm shift so that those mikvot become important for me, right? After all, if I don't have the paradigm shift, I won't care about, you know, I won't care about what happens in the 613. But once a paradigm shift occurs, now as I understand the 613, it helps me shift the way that I behave to align myself with the paradigm that I've already accepted. You understand? Okay, so that's 16. Now we have another really important verse. 17, and the reason that 17 is so important is because it starts introducing other themes that are connected to this. So let's take a look at 17. 4. In it, the righteousness of God is revealed from faith to faith, as it is written. And here comes the citation that's the fundamental idea of Romans, okay? But the righteous man shall live by faith. And you recognize where that comes from, right? You all know the prophet, right? Habakkuk, right? Comes from Habakkuk. And now we'll need to know, what does it say in the Tanakh? Because this translation depends on how I read the Tanakh. And then we'll need to ask, how is that related to the righteousness of God revealed from faith to faith? What does that mean? How can something be revealed from faith to faith? Okay, so we have lots of interesting questions going on in this verse. Okay, so once again,
Stern's translation says the righteous shall live by trust.
Okay, and maybe that's a little bit closer, but there's a whole issue with the syntax that we want to talk about. Okay? And we're going to get to that in a second. Okay. There might be other translations as well, but what we want to do is find out what the syntax is. Oh, let's see what Uriel ben Mordecai says about that verse. The righteousness of God in reality is revealed within it, emerging out of the, out from confidence, leading to trusting, just as it is written, that the ascetic, with his own trust, he shall live. Okay, so now we're going to go, we're going to have to go look at that verse in Habakkuk for sure. But first we need to understand what in the world Paul's talking about when he says from faith to faith, and what does the word righteousness mean? So the right, the word righteousness is dikaiosune. Okay? And you if you know Greek, you recognize that it comes, it's connected to the word dike, right? D-I-K-E, dike, right? In the first phrase. Okay, and so then we want to know a little bit of etymology. Where does this word come from, and how does it get to be so important in Paul's thought? So let me quickly scroll over to here and tell you how this all works. Okay, so the word group, the word dike is the word for justice, not righteousness, right? The word group that's connected to dike is dikaios, dikaiousine, dikaiou, a whole bunch of words that are connected to this root word. And here's the interesting thing. The root word is connected to the concept of law in the Tanakh. So, dike, the Greek word for, that's the basis for our word dikaiousine, its etymology, if we look back at it, is connected to the Hebrew word for Torah, right? So what does it have in mind? It's the concept of the influence of social relationships affected by theological ideas. Okay? So here's the idea. Behind the word for righteousness is not some creedal position, not some statement of beliefs. Behind the word for righteousness is the behavior that's a social relationship behavior that's dictated by a theological idea. So where does the theological idea come from? The revelation of God on Sinai. And what are the implications for human beings? That they have a certain set of beliefs? No, that they behave in a certain kind of way. So when Paul talks about righteousness, you can plug in there obedience to Torah. Because that's what he's really talking about, right? Righteousness isn't some kind of spiritual status that God grants me. Remember, there's that great phrase in Genesis that Luther uses, where God says, and it was accounted to him as righteousness. Remember, he's talking about God's relationship to Abraham. He says, wait a minute. Luther uses this to say, wait a minute. Don't you see that God gave Abraham what he calls, what Luther calls alien righteousness. That is, Abraham didn't have it, and God placed it on him. It was alien to Abraham because obviously Abraham wasn't following all of the laws because they didn't even exist, according to Luther. Yeah. And so God had to account him righteousness. In Luther's view, righteousness is like a spiritual merit badge. It's like a status symbol. Okay. And Abraham is given righteousness, right? But in the Pauline concept and in the idea that we get from the connection to Hebrew, righteousness is the process by which I demonstrate the application of Torah to my social relationships, right? Isn't that interesting? That what Paul is really talking about when he uses this Greek term is not some kind of spiritual status that I have, but the exhibition of my actions in the social arena that are based on the revelation from Sinai. Okay? So, now, that helps us understand the rest. Yes, Dennis, go ahead.
Isn't the just shall live by faith just another way of reiterating the Shema?
Wait till we get there, because okay. there's more than one way to read that the Hebrew syntax, right? So the first thing we want to settle is, what is righteousness? Not status symbol. It's Torah applied in social relationships. Okay, so now, why does Paul say, the righteousness of God revealed from faith to faith. Ah, okay. So now we have a really interesting word here, right? From faith to faith. And of course, the word pisteu, it's basically, Pam suggested that the translation was from faith to trust or something like that. But pisteo means to believe, to trust, pistis, to have faith, right? So that Greek term often gets used in Christian circles as the foundation for a statement of faith, because we think in the Western world that faith is based on a certain set of beliefs, and it becomes a cognitive thing. So if I ascribe to a certain number of beliefs, if I sign on the bottom line after a statement of faith, that means that I now have faith because I've given my mental approval. But you can see that if Paul's talking about righteousness as the application of Torah in social relationships, then faith can't be simply a set of beliefs. Faith has to be the trust in the revelation that God gave on Sinai so that I can act upon it in my social world. Okay?
So something Lindy. I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
No, I was going to say, so I was just telling Larry that to me, faith is based on something you haven't seen or haven't seen before, but trust is based on something that was already something that you've seen done that you can now in the future rely on.
Ah, okay. So what you've described in your definition of faith is a truly Western idea that faith is based on no evidence at all, and I just hope for it, right? I mean, I hope it's true, so I have faith in it. And what I mean is that there's no evidence, but I'd like it to be that way. And that, by the way, is exactly how Plato treats the idea of faith, that it's the projection of my wishes in hopes that they will come true. But that's not the way that faith is used in the New Testament, and it's certainly not the way that Paul uses faith, because for him, faith means the application of Torah in social relationships in such a way that my behavior is modified to fit the paradigm, right? So I have plenty of evidence for it. I have, even in Paul's time, 1,400 years of evidence of God's interaction with his people to bring about these certain kinds of behaviors, right?
Skip, faith is actually action.
Yes.
Because I can state all day long I have faith, and I can state all day long that the chair that I'm sitting on is going to hold me, but until I sit down on it, I mean, it's a word. It's just a word. It's like I can say anything. You know, I could say I'm a millionaire. I'd like to say I'm a millionaire and be one, but I don't, and have the faith that that's may someday happen. But the faith is really an action. If I say I have faith and
yeah.
I'm going to walk in it, it's an active word. Otherwise,
yeah. Okay,
it's,
and that's
it,
a good.
Otherwise, it's not.
Yeah, that's a good point, because remember I said that the word group begins with pisteu, the verb, okay? And the best example is the Gospel of John. John uses the word faith 92 times in the Gospel. It is never a noun. It's always a verb or a verb form. So, Lindy's right. Faith is not it's not a collection of statements. It's a way of behaving, right? So when Paul says the righteousness of God, and he's talking about the application of Torah to social relationships, from faith, from one set of actions to another set of actions, what do you suppose he's talking about now? From faith to faith. What does that mean? From one set of statements to another set of statements? Not a chance. He's not talking about cognitive stuff at all. He's talking about the revelation of Sinai giving me the way that I am supposed to respond in social relationships in the community, and I had that when God revealed it, okay, and that causes action, and now I have another set of action principles to put into place. What is the other set of action principles? The revelation of the Messiah, right? It's all tied back to the same tradition and history that's always been part of this concept that Paul is saying. This didn't start with Yeshua, it started with Abraham, and it's been moving along this line ever since, and now we have even more reason to understand how our faith works, how our action principles work, because we've seen it in the life of the Messiah. You understand? From faith to faith, okay? And this is the background for the way that he decides to read Habakkuk, because there's more than one way to read the verse, right? So now we're going to look at the syntax of the Hebrew so that we know what are the possibilities for how we read this verse, because for Paul, this is the summary verse of everything that he's going to say, right? So the last thing that now that we've given the background of it's about the revelation of Torah in the social responsibilities of community, and it's about action principles, the last thing we're going to expect in Habakkuk is some statement of creed. Okay, Pam, go ahead.
So this is kind of, you mentioned Abraham. Abraham came out of Ur. He was not the same Abraham that took his son up on the mountain. He had faith in God and started walking. And like Lindy said, you sit in the chair, then you have an experience, and that gives you more faith to move forward, so that by the time Abraham was called on to take his son up on the mountain, he was an entirely different man by then and was able to do that.
Yes.
Where
so
he could have never done that just walking out of Ur.
Right. It's interesting that you raised the issue of Abraham's sacrifice of Isaac. I was just reading yesterday a bunch of Jewish scholars dealing with that particular story and how difficult it is because of the supposed ethical conflict that's going on there. And we could talk about that at some length, but I think that's an appropriate way to look at what Paul is talking about. Like he's saying, you had a previous paradigm. Even if you were Jewish Orthodox, you had a previous paradigm. The paradigm might have been based on the revolution of Sinai, or if you're a Gentile coming into the assembly, you had another deity, okay? That process now, that paradigm shift that's occurred has moved you to see that Yeshua is the continuation of the revelation that God had in mind when he started with Abraham and then Moses, okay? And you've been living your life on the paradigm of Abraham and Moses, and now I want to add one more figure to this lineage. I want to add the Messiah, who will give you even more reason to understand how the action principles work that are the representation, or that are the essence of the, of, you know, the good news of God, right? So it's connected to the history. It's not as though Paul is coming in and saying, oh, wait a minute, we're going to stop and everyone's going to be converted into being Christians and we're going to have a new version of law and grace. Nope, that's not going to happen. Paul is basically tying all the knots back to the way that people live in the world, which is, by the way, what attracted people to Judaism in the first century in the first place. The only reason Paul has an audience is because he's going to talk to people about, let me help you understand how we can live in this world. Okay? Same thing that happens today. What's the most important thing about the mikvot today? How they're applied. No one's going to run around and worry about whether or not they're kindling a fire on Shabbat. You're going to worry about whether you turn on the stove, whether you turn on the electric light, if you can cook, and everything has to be modified for the culture that you're in. And Paul's doing the same thing. He's saying, okay, look, I'm going to go speak to the Jews, those being Jewish, and the Hellenes, because that's the world that I live in, and they need to understand what it is that God wants them to do. Okay, real simple. Okay, now let's go look at the verse in Habakkuk, because that's where we have to understand. How does Paul read this verse to support his claim? Okay, and this requires a general comment. You certainly by now you realize that the authors of the apostolic material feel perfectly free to rewrite what the prophets and what the Tanakh says in order to meet their agenda, right? They don't have any compunction about changing the word order, changing the syntax or the syntax, changing the grammar, because they have an agenda. So they use the prophetic announcements in order to fit their agenda. Okay? You understand that, right? We've spent a lot of time talking about the 23 examples in Matthew where he quotes from the prophets, and it's not what the prophets said, but it's kind of what the prophets said. Okay? So we expect Paul to do the same thing. In other words, we expect that Paul will modify what the prophets say in order to fit his agenda and not feel as though he's misquoting anything, because it was standard practice. No one was objecting to what he was doing. Everyone understood that that's the way the rabbis think. Okay? We have the same thing going on today. If you read rabbinic text today, you will see over and over, we said this many times, don't read it like this, read it like this, or change this vowel to this vowel, or whatever. They still have the flexibility to do that. Why? Because the text itself, as we've learned from our transmission stuff, the text itself might be canonized, but the interpretation of the text is variable. Okay? So now let's go look at the term, that the words in Habakkuk, and recognize that Paul can be a rabbi about this. Okay? So here's what we have. And it's in your notes, so you can follow it. Okay? Notice that the just shall live by faith, the usual way of translating this quotation, should probably be rendered, the one who by faith is just shall live. Did you get that? All I did was change the syntax. I just changed the word order. The just shall live by faith is the way that it's usually translated in the English Bible. And that's the way that it's usually translated when we read Romans, because the English Bible is using the same translation that it has in Habakkuk, right? But if you go look at the Hebrew syntax, you could read it, the one who by faith is just, which is the same as saying the one who applies the Mosaic principles in social relationships so that he is justified shall live. Okay? Think about how different that is. Okay? There is a slight change in the nuance. Can you see the difference? There are three reasons to accept this change, and then I'll give you those, and we'll talk about those in a second. But first thing I want you to recognize is the difference between the just shall live by faith, which means that, essentially, if you're just, then you're faithful. The just shall live by faith. It's my faithfulness that causes me to be justified. Okay? As opposed to the one who by faith is just shall live. Okay? The one who by faith is just. That is, the one who, because he accepts the Sinaitic paradigm and acts accordingly, that person shall live. Right? Do you see the difference? And those of you that I see on the video, I can't tell, right? But this is really important, because one of them suggests that the way that you will find life, right, is by faith. The other suggests that life is the product of living out the principles that act as justification, right? Big difference. One of them is, if I just have faith, God will save me. The other is, hey, I'm going to act out these principles, and on the basis of that, I'll have life. Right?
Yeah.
One of them is kind of like the end of Deuteronomy, when Moses says, okay, here are the principles. Choose one or choose the other. Choose life. Live this way or act this way, and you will live. And Habakkuk, read like that, says, act this way. Act according to the messianic principles given for social responsibility, that will justify you and you will live. Okay? Skip, Linda, you had something to say?
I went and got the Tanakh and wanted to read it in the way it was written in the art scroll anyway. Yeah. And it says, behold, his soul, in, with an asterisk, soul is defiant. It is unsettled in him. But the righteous person shall live through his faith. And then Stern has, look at the proud. He's inwardly not upright. But the righteous will attain life through trusting faithfulness.
So yes, okay. But Yeah, and trusting faithfulness is probably even a better representation, because what it says is essentially the reason that the person is alive is because they put they've adopted the paradigm of acting on the basis of the Mosaic Code. Because trusting faithfulness is not trusting in a list of statements or a declaration of the, you know, of the sinner's prayer. Trusting faithfulness in Hebrew context has to be connected to living according to the Mosaic Code.
Yeah, I was just looking at
and that's the point that I'm trying to get at. If we read the verse, the just shall live by faith, we might think that the most important thing is faith. And then, of course, that leads us to statements of belief. But if we read the one who by faith is just shall live, then it's no longer a matter of I have to have faith. It's a matter of how do I apply these things so that life is the result. Okay? You see the shift? It's just a little change in the syntax, in the way that the verse is translated. But of course, now you realize that Hebrew can be translated in lots of different ways, because Hebrew syntax is all over the place as well. It doesn't follow any English standard syntax formulation. So it's possible to read it both ways. But one way pushes us in the direction of a cognitive acceptance, and the other way pushes in the direction of a dynamic acceptance. One is about action. One is about thoughts. Okay? Really important, because this becomes the basis of everything that Paul's going to develop from here on. Okay? Now let's finish these notes. And I give you the three reasons to accept this change. First, Paul's talking about righteousness, not about how to live. He's talking about, and what is righteousness? We've already defined that. Remember, righteousness is the connection to decay, which is the connection to law, which is the connection to Moses. Okay? So, second, if we look at chapters
Excuse me, Skip. Just on that please, Skip. Haven't we just been talking about righteousness is about the way to live in accordance with Torah?
Yes.
So,
yeah,
when
we're
you
talking
say,
about righteousness.
So, direct Paul connection to Paul is talking about righteousness, not about how to live. But isn't righteousness how living according to Torah?
Okay. I see you're talking about my sentence. Paul is talking about the application of Torah, the application of Torah principles to the social relationship. But the emphasis in his verse is not about are you going to live. The emphasis in the verse is application of the principle. The consequence live is a byproduct. Not the goal. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Right.
Look at
the action.
Okay? If I say the one who by faith is just, then what I'm saying is the importance is by faith is just, not life. Life is the byproduct. The important thing is, am I aligned? Okay?
Yep. It's our actions in the manner in which we are living. We can live it in the way in which the Torah, if we live the way in which the Torah, we could all not lock our doors. But if we lived in that manner, then we are living in the way of walking into being, I hate the word righteousness.
Yes.
Back to action. It's not just words.
But maybe what we need is some clarification over the word live. Because we think in the Western world, to be alive is to live. And so since I'm animated, I must be living. But that's not a Torah idea. The Torah idea of living is to be in connection with God, right? So I can be animated, as I can breathe and move and everything, and not be in connection with God, and I'm not alive. I'm only waiting for the end, okay? But what Paul is interested in is being alive. That is, being in relationship with God. And the way that that happens is because I act on the basis of the principles which justifies me, and those principles are the ones that I find in the Mosaic Code and continuing through the Messiah. Yeah, okay? So does that make sense? Okay, so then that gives me only two more points here, and then we'll finish today. Second, if we look at chapters 1 to 4, we find words about faith 25 times and words about living only twice. But in chapters 5 through 8, and remember, 5 through 8 is the new man, the issue with the law, the overwhelming graciousness of God. That's what happens in 5, 6, 7, and 8, right? What do we find there? 25 times words about living and words about faith, only twice. Exactly the opposite in relation to the vocabulary, okay? So he's making a really important point now about how faith applies. And then later he's going to talk about how living functions as a result of that, okay? Clearly, Paul's interested in faith as the subject of the first part of this letter. And third, the whole teaching of Romans is to connect righteousness with faith. The whole teaching of Romans is to connect dike, which is the law, with my trust. Okay? So, we are to conclude that Paul is telling us about how a person is connected to dike, how he's connected to the law, not about how a law-connected person shall stay alive. Okay? Got it? Oh, it's something for you to think about for the next week. Okay, I have an obligation in 15 minutes, so we will have to cut. We'll have to stop here. But these are two really critical verses, and if you come up with questions, let's get them right off the top next week, because from this point on, Paul's going to take this prophetic idea and just start applying it across all the groups that he wants to talk to in this assembly, okay? You have all your notes there. Don't forget to download the new copy of the notes for 1 to 15 so that you have that little thing about spiritual gifts. And then I will see you next week, same time, on Saturday, same station, okay? Enjoy. I'll talk to you just before the new Julian year. Bye.